Brigadier Calvert, Rail 5.
I was mentioning that the chief of police, name was Gray, had some private faults which rather laid himself open, if not blackmail, but to pressure. The Malay sultans were of a varied lot. Some were very good, others were absolute, as you might call them, charlatans or knaves. They behaved as if Malaya belonged to them, and this goes back to the federated and unfederated Malay states when we took it over. But what wasn't known by an awful lot of people was that the Malay sultans, most of the Malay sultans, were descendants from a conquering race from the Celebes Islands, now called Celebes, C-E-L-E-B-E-S, now called, I think, Salewar. And they had conquered Malaya, rather like the Normans conquered Britain, and had imposed their rule on the native Malays. So they themselves were, this is about 150 to 200 years ago, so they themselves were a ruling race, and many of their antecedents hadn't been in Malaya as long as many of the Chinese who'd traded in Malaya and settled in Malaya from up to 500 or 600 years beforehand. And throughout all the history of Malaya is this rivalry between the very hard-working, clever Chinese and the Malays, who were much more lethargic and weren't prepared to work. You can see the similarity in Fiji with the Indians and the Fijians. So there were great rivalries about, and one was rather trying to be enrolled on one side or the other.
Were you going to relate this to the police force?
Yes. Well, the Gray was prevailed upon to support the Malay sultans in a way which, in my humble opinion, was not well, what we now call racist. It didn't give the balance of justice between the Malays and the Chinese. However, our job was to help beat the guerrillas, whatever they were, and I got on with training for it. But one thing which followed me all the time was that we were expected to produce results at very short notice. My force was the officers came as volunteers, and I managed to recruit some. I had to go up to Hong Kong and to Singapore and elsewhere, and I recruited quite a lot. A lot of officers who wanted to come weren't allowed to come by their colonels. And the men were almost drafted to me. I got some very good ones and some who were not so good. But I went on the theory of General Wingate that any man can command good troops, but it takes real leadership to transform mediocre troops into good troops. So I faced that. General Harding had made it quite clear to me that I couldn't take volunteers throughout the army, because this would upset the army too much. And I think I have mentioned that there was this lot of ex-prisoner of war officers who had come back, and many of them were commanding battalions, who'd received their promotion as prisoners of war and were completely outdated. And they hated any sort of newfangled ideas. And you can see their point of view. They wanted to get on with resuscitating their battalions into a peacetime regiment. So there was a lot of strains. Now, another strain was, I don't think I've mentioned yet, is I had to serve about three masters. General Urquhart was GOC Malaya, a very nice man, but with rather limited knowledge of the world as a whole. And he had a lot of pressure to bear on him by his ex-Indian Army Chief of Staff, who'd hated Wingate and the Chindits. General Harding, I had access to him at all times. Now, possibly foolishly, and looking back, this is one thing I think I did wrong. General Harding said I could come and see him whenever I liked, or write to him or get in touch with him. After my experience with Special Forces and with Wingate, I tried to build up confidence with the rest of the army in Malaya by not rushing off and seeing the Commander-in-Chief. So I tried to do things through GOC Malaya or Chief of Staff Malaya and not go running to Harding when I should have done. And there are a number of things that I should have seen Harding. They may seem small things, but things like getting a good adjutant, getting a good quartermaster, which are essential when you're forming a unit, and getting a good RSM. And many other points, I should have gone and seen him. And the third thing was General Briggs had arrived, and if you remember, it was... He made a plan, the Briggs plan, which General Templer carried out. Well, General Briggs was the first to say that he had read my report on Malaya, my 48-page report, and that he had adapted it to what he thought was correct, but he had made use of my report a lot. And I liked him, and I'd known him before, and I used to see him. But where I did see him was I was approached by one of the guerrilla colonels whom I met, or rather he arranged to meet me, in a Chinese restaurant. And he just wanted to have a contact. That he didn't want to fight the British. He liked the British. And he wanted to make contact with me so that I could present his views. I told Briggs that, and Briggs said, "Now, don't tell anybody else, just let me know." So anything I got from this guerrilla colonel, regimental commander, as you put it, I used to tell General Briggs. But it wasn't a hell of a lot. But it did put a strain on me, having, you might say, three generals to communicate with. At the same time, I had to actually train people. I was taking them out at 6 a.m. on physical training, on throwing grenades, on rifle fire, lecturing them. Seeing they went into the jungle, how they operated in the jungle, also having to deal with quartermastering affairs like losses of equipment and things like that, and administration. All these men, although most of them were very keen, were not quite used to the loosening of discipline, which I insisted on, and that one or two took advantage of it. I forget whether I've mentioned this before. Oh, yes, I did, because you said the same thing had happened with the long-range desert group. I had to sort of break down the natural discipline of the British Army so that people would act on their own without orders. This was the fault I'd seen during the war, that people would see the enemy, and when asked, why didn't you shoot, they said, but I had no orders to do so. And so I had to retrain the men's minds and release them from discipline and then try and give them a new discipline, what I used to call, and I had called this the same, I'd given the same lectures in Australia and New Zealand and with the Chindits. I wanted the discipline of what I call the fighter pilot. I learned later that the original discipline of the fighter pilot was changed later, but what, as I saw it, was that he would, during the Battle of Britain, he'd be sent up, and he would make his choice, and he would fire and shoot, and it was a offensive action. He didn't just wander around waiting for orders. And this was the discipline I wanted. I've also mentioned it was the discipline which the original Jesuits had. Although they were working apart from each other, they knew what was to be done and acted and did things what they hoped was the best. And that's how the Jesuits produced such good armies, like in Paraguay and elsewhere. And so I had to go off to Rhodesia to raise a Rhodesian Special Air Service, and I had to go up to Thailand, and as you can see, I was extremely busy. And I also had to attend all top-level conferences where my opinion was always asked, but at the same time deal with all the paperwork. It was a great strain. Now, as I saw it, my method of this, which I had written in my report, was that the guerrillas, and this is true and pretty well everywhere, they have their bases quite some distance away from their targets. And it's there they train and brainwash their men, and then, say the target is a railway line, they have operational bases within possibly a day's march, say 15 miles, 20 miles in from the jungle, and then they have an overnight hideout near their base, near their target. And that's within just 2 or 3 miles or less of the railway line or road, whatever it is. And each guerrilla unit is given a task to do, and possibly to interrupt the railway or the road. And he's given a norm which he must achieve. Maybe, say, blow up 2 bridges every 2 months. And then he's given he makes his plan, and he can do that once he's found out what the sentries do, depending on the moon and the weather so on and so forth after his reconnaissance, and he is expected to carry it out, and it's in his hands. The counterinsurgency people were responding or reacting to guerrilla activities. If a railway was blown, they'd rush into the area and try and find the guerrillas. The guerrillas in the meantime, who were very fast through the jungle, would have left. The government forces would may find a few shelters which they'd stayed overnight and dramatically burn them and say, "We have destroyed a guerrilla encampment." But they never found the main camps of the guerrillas, and they never caught the guerrillas within their camps, not even the Gurkhas, who stayed in longer. There were some silly things, one by a doctor saying that nobody should stay in the jungle for more than a week, and a lot of the battalions took this as a sort of get-out, so they didn't have to stay in too long. The other thing, what I saw was the key to the jungle fighting, were the Aborigines. Now, the Aborigines was of all sorts. They were, some might say, very Aboriginal. They had no clothes on and no, literally no possessions, because I wanted to give them gifts, and I tried to the controller of Aborigines what I should give them, and he says, "Very difficult to know." And the Chinese guerrillas had paid great attention to making friends with these Aborigines, and this had gone on right the way throughout the war, and they had looked after them and dealt kindly with them. Whereas the British Army method was, if they saw any hutments anywhere, or this, that, and the other, was to bomb them. They didn't go into them, and there was this business of just these wretched people got bombed or shot if they were ever seen by the British. And so that made them very anti the white man. But there was a controller of Aborigines, and I decided that one of our objects was to win the Aborigines over to our side. And they were the ears and eyes of the guerrillas. They were marvellous in the jungle, and they were rather like the schoolboy storybooks. They could vanish into the jungle, and they could appear in the jungle without any noise or anything. They were amazingly good. Now, there are some which were more civilized than others, who they grew their own crops. They had that method of burning an area and growing crops and staying on it until somebody died. Then they reckoned that there was a bad joss, and they moved to another area. So that's where they left. You got the secondary jungle, which is very dense. But it did mean that there were plantations of pineapples, tapioca, and other things right in the jungle on which troops could live, and which the guerrillas used to use in emergencies. So the guerrillas could actually live without coming out into the open. Now, so I did arrange to operate with the director, the forget the name they called him, protector of the Aborigines, one of his men who is a son of an air marshal, and we called him Jungle Jim, who was a very fine man, but he'd been badly wounded in the war, and he had a brass plate on his head, and he would sometimes shoot the wrong people, and he'd been in trouble in that way, just purely through a pressure on his brain. It was no character fault. You're a very fine man. Um, So how I trained my men is, having trained them at, we moved up from Johor to a place called Dusan Tur, which was hot springs about 50 miles south of the capital, Kuala Lumpur. We had a matchhead hut barracks there, and these hot springs had a medical value, and they were very, I thought that they'd be very useful in getting rid of the skin diseases which people suffered from by being in the jungle. And this was so. And we trained there. Then I would send people out, because I felt the only way to train people was by getting them out. And so they'd go under, about 14 men under a subaltern, and they'd stay in the jungle, be given tasks. And slowly they learnt. Now, I think there again, I possibly expected them to learn without supervision. And what I've heard at reunions and so on, I should have gone out earlier with them, like we did it with the Chindits, taking the officers out on patrol for six or eight weeks, and then they could have taught their men. But you can see that I had so many other obligations that this was difficult. I did go out for 6 weeks once. When I got back, General Urquhart gave me a very great ticking off, being away from my unit all so long, whereas I was training inside. General Urquhart had no idea of things. When I went to Rhodesia, I was away for 21 days. I did 22,000 miles in 21 days without a regular route. I had to buy my ticket on the way. I gave two lectures in Kenya, where the Mau Mau was just starting, and then I formed an SAS unit in Rhodesia, having to see the Governor General and Commander-in-Chiefs and everything else, and came back again in 21 days, which I reckon is travelling, and he again had me up and said, why had I been away so long? There was continual pressure in that way. Now, one of the things I'd done whilst at Johor, I don't know whether I mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. I had known the value of helicopters. We'd had a few helicopters in Burma, which a lot of people don't realize, which the Americans had taken us, but they didn't come into the jungle with us because their maintenance broke down. But I was very keen on having some helicopters. As I saw, it's the only method of putting people into the jungle and taking the wounded out again. I tried the RAF, and they said they weren't interested. I tried the army. They said that they couldn't maintain them. And so I heard the Navy had some. So instead of writing to Lord Louis Mountbatten, I wrote to Lady Louis Mountbatten, who is head of the Red Cross, International Red Cross, and saying we needed helicopters to evacuate wounded of either side. I knew she would get on to her husband, which she did, and her husband, there was an aircraft carrier somewhere in those parts, and he ordered a helicopter to go and train with us. And so I took part with the pilot in taking off and landing and finding out exactly what helicopter strip needed and what helicopters could do. And I put in my report, and I brought the general down to see it and so on like that. And we eventually got some RAF helicopters in that way. I mention all this because somebody's written a history of the helicopters, and they say that they were the first, the RAF were the first people into Malaya. It wasn't. It was the Royal Navy helicopters which started it. And so So now we could deposit people into the jungle, and what I was after was the main bases of the jungle, of the guerrillas. What the guerrillas did, they had good recruits from the wartime period. They were getting old. They needed new ones, and their source was schoolmasters. And schoolmasters were told, communist-minded schoolmasters were told to choose likely-looking lads who were very athletic and who could be indoctrinated and whose parents were there and whom pressure could be brought on to bear. And when the regiments decided they need some more recruits, the schoolmasters were asked to provide them, and they did so. They then went into these long-term camps in the deep jungle. That's probably 40, 50 miles away from a road. And they were trained very hard. We went into one of these jungles, and I took my whole of the first essay, the first 22nd essays, into that jungle, and we trained from them, from the very huts that the Chinese guerrillas had used. And the there they indoctrinated them and trained them. What they'd done, the jungle trees produce a canopy of about 150 to 200 feet high. Below that, there is not secondary jungle, but creepers, lanyards, and this, that, and the other. Well, different density, depending where it is. On the tops of hills and ridges, it's fairly sparse. On in streams and valleys, it can become very, very dense indeed. And they trained them there very strictly, and both politically and for active service and shooting and so on. They were very good camps. They weren't at the top of any particular geographical promontory which could be identified. They weren't at the top of a mountain or at the crossroads of a junction of a stream, so they weren't easily seen from the air. The undergrowth was cut, and they had a sort of parade ground underneath the canopy. The water supply was from a stream. First of all, it was a little dam was made, and water, running water, was laid on by bamboos, hollow, the half sections of bamboos, directing the water all the way down. The next thing was a cookhouse over the stream,